This is Ag Bioscience. Welcome, and thanks for joining. I'm Mitch Frazier, President and CEO of Agrinovis Indiana. This is the podcast where we explore all things Ag Bioscience, the people, the products, and innovations across food, animal health, plant science, and ag tech. Ag Bioscience companies attracted more than $50 billion in venture capital globally in 2021, but venture isn't the only source of funding fueling innovation. Private equity and debt are also flowing into the ag bioscience economy as investors seek new avenues to deliver returns and advance innovation. These financial instruments serve a vital role in the ag bioscience economy, but they may be changing as interest rates rise and the broader tech economy cools. Joining us today to share more about the role of venture, private equity, and debt are three financial experts and active investors. Welcome Patrick Gilbert with private equity firm Vine Capital, Randall Lewis with Chicago-based venture capital firm Cleveland Avenue, and Steve Witkes, a longtime lender and debt expert with Farm Credit Mid-America. Patrick, Randall, Steve, welcome to Ag Bioscience.
Good morning.
Thank you for having us.
Oh, this is going to be fun, gents. Access to the diverse sources of capital, really a mystery, I think, for many entrepreneurs and even big companies alike. Randall, I want to start with you. You've been a banker, deep experience in debt, now a venture capitalist. You're employing an entirely different financial instrument in VC than you did in your prior life. Share with us more about your story, Cleveland Avenue, and the unique role you see venture playing in advancing ag bioscience companies.
Sure. And thank you, Mitch, for having me. It's a pleasure to participate in this morning's podcast with you, Patrick, and Steve. And also, I got to say this to you, Mitch, and your team. Thank you for all that you do to serve as an advocate for the state in this area of ag biosciences. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
My story, this will be short, but my story is I'm proud to say I'm a native of Indiana. Went to school here, both undergrad and grad at Purdue in accounting and finance, and spent 25 years of my career in Fortune 200 companies. One of the capacities in which I served in while with those companies was in M&A. Mm-hmm. So always interested in building and supporting organizations in that way. Made a shift after that time period and start working on entrepreneurial ventures as well as assisting entrepreneurs. The last 3 years, I've been with Cleveland Avenue, a venture capital firm that's headquartered in Chicago, was founded by Don Thompson. Don, also a Purdue grad, went to high school here in Indianapolis. And Don was also the former CEO of McDonald's about three CEOs ago. Cleveland Avenue deploys capital through four funds. Two of those funds are investments in agri-fund companies. One of the funds is a technology company focused on lifestyle technologies. And then the final is a fund that's targeted at those communities, I would say, that are underserved. Those individuals being people of color, as well as women founders who are in search of VC capital. So those are the funds that we have. This year, we will deploy over $100 million in capital this year. And we're glad about that. We feel that VC serves a very important role where it basically bridges, I'll call it the gap between sources of funds for innovation and call it traditional financing, which is generally a lot less expensive. But at that time, there are a lot more knowns than unknowns in which we support from a VC perspective. You had mentioned the type of instruments that we deploy, Mitch, as well. Capital is generally in the form of a convertible note instrument. That note would then convert into a preferred equity security, as well as preferred equity itself. Those structures, provide us the appropriate protections and upside sharing necessary to meet our return requirements.
Really helpful, Randall. And I think there's more to dig into currently, given the environment that we're seeing globally as rates rise and other things become of challenge to both investors and to companies alike. And Patrick, I want to come to you. You too have had a deep experience in M&A. You've done quite a bit of work now at private equity firm Vine Capital. Share more about your story, more about Vine Capital, and where do you see private equity's unique role in advancing food and ag bioscience companies?
Yeah, thanks, Mitch. Thanks for having me. It's great to be with you, Randall and Steve, today and have the opportunity to dialogue and learn from you guys. As we think about backgrounds and kind of where we end up in terms of the work we do, I always like to say that today's burden often becomes tomorrow's vision. Today's burden often becomes tomorrow's vision. And I say that because we really ought to pay attention to the type of problems that trouble us today, because it gives us indication of the type of things that we'll be working on tomorrow. And when I think about my background, that's certainly the case. I have a traditional accounting and finance background as well. And early in my career, I had the opportunity to work on large public transactions. And the one thing I learned pretty quickly about public transactions is that the deal terms and the price are often set long before the accountants and the consultants come in to do any work. And, for somebody that's early in their career, that can be pretty frustrating. But it's predominantly because the deal information is mostly transparent at the public company level, and those deals are done for the synergies that they're perceived to produce. So over time, I began to gravitate more towards the lower middle market, and I began to work more with private equity companies who are buying family-owned, founder-owned businesses with, let's say, revenues of $250 million and below. And unlike public company transactions where information is pretty transparent, in the lower middle market, deal information is pretty opaque. And that creates an opportunity or a challenge, I guess, depending on which side of the transaction you're on. But instead of really confirming information that I was doing at the public company level, I began to learn how to create information that the buyer wanted to know but didn't. And in many instances, what I was doing was creating informational arbitrage. I was quantifying information for the buyer that maybe the seller only knew by instinct. And then I would give that information over to the buyer, and they would use that to negotiate the best deal. And so you do that enough times, and I thought, well, gee, I think maybe more of this value ought to stay with the seller. And so I began to work more with owners ahead of transactions to help them enhance the value of their companies so that they could, retain more of that value. And so working in between the buyers and the sellers really provided me a unique perspective. And it created in me some really deep convictions around what is true value and how traditional private equity creates it. And I began to sense that while traditional private equity does a lot of things really well, there are some significant shortcomings. So, for example, when you think about traditional private equity, they're taking institutional capital, money from insurance companies and pension funds, and they're deploying that and creating value in a relatively short period of time in order to provide a return back to those investors. And what I observed is that these actions sometimes didn't always optimize the long-term value of the business. And so it seemed to me that maybe a more flexible private capital model would be best to optimize businesses, at least in the long term. So I say that because that was my burden, and Vine Capital kind of became my vision. I was hired on to help form Vine Capital, and Vine Capital is a discrete family office. So unlike a traditional PE that raises capital through those institutional investors, the form of our capital is private. And there are really kind of three things that distinguish us. One, we are sector focused. So we only invest in food and agriculture related companies. typically between about 1 to 20 million in EBITDA. The second thing is that we're flexible in terms of our capital structure, which allows us to customize solutions for owners. So where traditional private equity does the control and the buyout deals, we'll do some of that. But we also do growth capital and minority investing as well. And then the third thing that that leads into is that we're very active and we're highly consultative. You know, we talk about that investing is a deeply human endeavor, and it's important to not only align with the business, but also to align with the owners and the management teams. So that's my background. That's a little bit about Vine. You know, as we think about the role of private equity in general as it relates to the food and ag bioscience sectors, you know, I would say that we have to look first at the problem and then what solution private equity offers. So look at the problem and the solution that private equity offers. And so in the food, ag bioscience sectors, you know, the challenge we have before us is a changing supply, demand, and dynamic. Depending on who you ask, we have an estimate that the world population grows to 10 billion by 2050. And that's going to create a need for additional demand on food up to 60 to 100%. So we have this growing demand, but we also have the challenge of limited supply. And the food supply chain is bound by certain natural resource limitations. So the question becomes, how do we not only produce more food, but how do we do so more efficiently? And so I think that's where private equity really has an opportunity. Because what private equity does really well is it forces or it creates capital efficient decision making. So capital efficiency, right? It's the means by which we determine how to allocate limited resources. And so, you know, as I take a look at things, I think that that's the reason today we're seeing more private equity dollars flowing into the sector. And I think to answer your question, I believe it's really the contribution that the private equity is going to make in fueling the growth of these sectors as well.
Really helpful, Patrick. And capital efficiency really becoming paramount across all the sectors of the economy. Eager to spend some more time on that. Steve, I want to come to you. You are a longtime farm credit lender. You've worked with farmers, you've worked with big publicly traded companies in the ag bioscience sector. If you would, give us a little bit of background on you, the role that farm credit plays specifically around traditional lending or debt, and maybe how you see that advancing innovation in ag bioscience.
Yeah, well, again, I want to thank you too, Mitch, for everything you do. And it's an honor to be on this podcast panel here. Although after listening to Randall and Patrick, I'm like, oh my gosh, I should have went first. But yeah, as Mitch said, I will have been with the Farm Credit System come 37 years next month. So I've had a long history with the organization. I'm originally from Illinois. Born and raised in a small, or, you know, at the time was a decent sized grain livestock farm, and still have ties back there today. Most of my career has been working with Illinois, the Farm Credit Association in Illinois. I joined the team here in Indiana. It'll be 4 years coming up here in a couple of months. And in my current role, I'm the senior vice president of lending for Indiana, which means I basically lead the state team here in Indiana. And, you know, our organization is, you know, if you're not familiar with the Farm Credit System, we're nationwide, and the system is made up of district banks and then associations. So we are the second largest farm credit association in the nation. We have about $35 billion in assets. And, you know, our delivery is anywhere from the retail branch teams that I lead. Predominantly, we're working with investors and traditional farmers. We have a middle markets team that works with, you know, those segments that, you know, Patrick, you kind of talked to the, you know, the 20 million type investments and what have you. And then we have a food and agribusiness team. And Mitch, that's where most of our exposure probably gets at the highest level with the large companies. And my experience with working with them has really just been knowledge-based just because I'm a part of the company more than directly working with them. So most of my experience over the years has been working with our traditional farmers. And when I think about where do we fit in this whole thing, I think it's all about, you know, how we work with our farmers to, you know, to take advantage of that innovation that's being created via whatever means that capital to get these initiatives off the ground and what have you. So, you know, we're all about ag. You know, obviously, ag innovation has been alive and well forever. When I was thinking about getting on here this podcast today, just thinking about all the changes that have taken place in just traditional ag since I have joined the organization back in the mid 80s is quite phenomenal. When you look at what they're doing today with, you know, plant, the knowledge of the plant, the technologies used to know, you know, the health of the plants and the placement of chemical and fertilizer and the timing of it. And, you know, they're just, the technology is really fascinating what's going on within what I consider just traditional agriculture. And so I think the people I work with predominantly are consumers of that innovation that is funded, I think, in large part by organizations like Randall and Patrick. So it's, you know, great to be here and you know, a pleasure to be a part of Agrinovus as well.
Oh, Steve, thank you. And thanks for your support. I think you representing the end user, right? The idea of the farmer where actual point of production happens. Patrick, you talk a lot about capital efficiency. Randall, you've offered a couple different views. I want to dig into venture. I think venture is one of those pieces that is often looked to as the go-to source of capital for high growth, high opportunity startups, whether they're in field, whether they're a food component. The challenge is with inflation, again, higher than we would like to see it. Interest rates continue to rise. We see a turbulent global environment, a cooling tech sector, lots of layoffs of late. What's the right financial instrument for companies to fuel growth? And I don't care who takes it. Whoever wants to jump on that one first, take it and run.
I'll give you a quick shot on that.
Perfect.
You know, all the things you mentioned that's going on now with the macroeconomic climate, you made it sound almost like it's a real downer, Mitch. It's challenging, but there are a lot of positive things going on out there. I say that jokingly, but it's one of the things that really get me excited about what I do. I joined Cleveland Avenue just before the pandemic. And one of the uplifting things in such a turbulent time period was the fact that you still had all these great ideas and innovation being basically put forward when things were really, really bad. So I say that jokingly to you, Mitch, but there are some good things happening out there. And I think the answer to your question, what's the right instrument? It's going to depend a lot on the company. It's going to depend on the company that's seeking the capital. It's going to have a lot to do with that company's capacity for debt. It's going to have a lot to do with what's that company's, I'll say, attitudes and preference around dilution when you start thinking about equity solutions. I would tend to think that the more predictable and stable you have positive cash flow, that tends to lend itself more to debt than it would equity. But I would also say that the answer doesn't have to necessarily be an either or at the same time. So that's how I respond to that question, Mitch.
Love it. Patrick?
Yeah, I'd say, listen, I think uncertainty always drives the source of capital, right? Uncertainty is always going to drive the source of capital. And, you know, listen, if you start from a purely theoretical perspective, right, where there's no uncertainty, you know, the optimal capital structure is going to be one which minimizes your combined cost of debt and equity. And so, you know, your cost of capital declines as you employ lower cost of debt in proportion to your equity. And then once you achieve that optimal balance, any additional debt that you put on actually increases your cost of capital because of the additional financial leverage. But like that's in theory, right? So in practice, there's a lot of uncertainty, which again, always drives the source of capital. So, you know, the question is, what's that mean? I think it means that the right financial instrument, to Randall's point, is dictated by macro and micro risk factors in your business. And, you know, those risk factors are distributed differently across the continuum based on the size and risk profile of your business. And so as you think about venture and early stage and emerging type companies, there's a lot of uncertainty about growth and market and competition, but there's also a lot of execution risk, which requires more proactive involvement. And so the higher the uncertainty, the more you'll lean towards equity because your capital structure has to acknowledge those basic risks. But as you move more towards the right of the continuum into the lower middle market, you have less execution-based risk and you have more macro-driven risks. And I think, again, to Randall's point, as a result, larger companies lend themselves more easily to debt financing because of the stable cash flows. But here's kind of what I see happening just from, you know, just a general PE perspective. I think we've always had certain levels of risk throughout the continuum. But I think the greater uncertainty that's happening at the macro level is causing some different things to happen in PE. You know, as interest rates go up, valuations go down, and it puts a lot more pressure on private equity buyers to really find ways to add value because they simply can't generate the financial returns that they're used to because of the higher cost of debt. And so when you look at it, trying to answer the question about what the optimal financial instrument is, well, it depends upon those factors. But what I will say is that in times of greater uncertainty, we're going to see a need for more equity-based financing and the corresponding need for more proactive involvement from investors.
Makes a lot of sense. Steve, thoughts on debt?
Yeah, you know, as I'm listening to Patrick talk about the uncertainty, that's something that I think is always in play. At least from our perspective, the more uncertainty, the more challenging it is to place that debt, you know, from that standpoint. And so, you know, obviously, Farm Credit, we don't get into private equity, venture capital, and those type of things. So, you know, debt, to Randall's point, you know, interest rates are up. There's no doubt they are. We've got a generation ahead of us that we're dealing with right now that really have not experienced these kind of interest rates. And historically speaking, they're really not out of line at this point in time. But compared to where we've been the last 10 to 15 years, they certainly are. But, you know, we, at least in my role, in my team, you know, and investing in innovations that are created by private equity venture that trickle down to our customers, we're going to be better positioned to always do that, the less certainty there is within a borrower's ability to make those investments. And we still got a ways to go in our industry on really elevating our game when it comes to overall quality financial statements, because the capital demands continue to soar, as everybody knows. And you know, when you invest more, you get more risk involved. And so, you know, the debt market right now is very, it's strong, right? I mean, there's a lot of demand. There's a lot of lenders like there out of themselves that are wanting to be in this game yet, in agriculture, sure, and agribias. So supply of debt is not an issue at this point in time.
I think your point on market attractiveness, Steve, is one that I think it's really important for us to dig into, because as we look at the most macro, we see a lot of volume of dollars, a lot of volume of interest really coming into the food and ag bioscience space, really as companies, and I would even argue funds, search new ways to try to meet environmental commitments, to whether it's ESG, whether it's a simple focus on sustainability. What are y'all seeing from companies today? Are you seeing this desire for capital really being met with efficiency in a world where things are really tough, that, you know, those companies who are capital efficient, Patrick, to your point earlier, are really emerging as the breakaways? Are we seeing companies still continuing to really put fuel on the fire, really say, hey, look, we're not focused on profitability today. We're focused on growth and growth only. Give us an idea of what you're seeing from companies on deal flow on your fronts, please.
Yeah, I mean, I think as you think about sustainability as it relates to, you know, your question of what are companies doing, and is sustainability, how is it playing out? I think from my perspective, sustainability really only works if it's driving innovation, which leads to more efficient use of resources. Okay. And so I see companies that are still trying to kind of figure out how to best approach sustainability, especially as it becomes a core tenet to their business model. Mm-hmm. And so as we think about large companies, they've driven a lot of this, and it's starting to factor in and trickle down to these lower middle market companies. And so when I look at companies in terms of deal flow and how they're talking about sustainability, I'm really seeing two different things. I see some companies that, you know, maybe more, you know, to your point on the aggressive end, which kind of use sustainability maybe only as a marketing theme, and they're trying to figure out kind of how to integrate it into being a core principle of their business model. But it's really uncertain how they're translating the actual benefits into areas of cost and reduction and quality and speed to market. Now, I think certainly for those companies that I see that can translate those commitments into more efficient use of resources and translate that into the economics, then that's clearly a differentiator. And those are the type of companies that we're interested in. But on the other hand, I see and I work with a lot of more established companies that are really trying to struggle to figure out how to make the changes that are necessary to stay relevant. And you could think about these companies being, you know, a little bit more on the conservative end. And I'd say this is where a transition of ownership and capital partnership can be valuable to reset the future of the company based on innovation. Because, I mean, I think in the end, you know, disruptive innovation is going to come, you know, in Randall's space. It's going to come out of the early stage. And sustaining innovation, which is an evolution of existing systems, is likely coming out of a later stage. But, you know, for me, the sustainability and the purpose in terms of what we see really goes back to your point about capital efficiency and decision making. And for those companies that can lead with those sustainable commitments and translate them into actual cost savings and market capture, there's opportunity. But I think the key here is to strike the balance between the two.
I think that's very well said, Patrick. I think one of the byproducts of the economic environment that we operate in today, we talked about rising interest rates, its impact on valuations. It's taking companies longer periods of time to raise capital. The very nature of that fact is causing companies to strike, to Patrick's point, a better balance between top line growth and profitability. And what we're seeing is a lot of companies who might have been closer to the grow at any cost now have kind of leveled that out a little bit, and they focus more on becoming a lot more profitable sooner in that company's life cycle. And that latter reaction in today's marketplace, along with this idea around purpose, sustainability, and food, it's those together that's really selling in the market today.
Super helpful. Steve, thoughts?
The only thing I would add, I mean, I think our industry is, you know, we're not perfect, but we are tremendous stewards of the resources that we have in this great country. And you know, sustainability and environmental impact are all, I think, things that actually I believe our industry does quite well. And, you know, I think there's an interest and we see that as something to be a partner with, too, in taking part in promoting advances in technology and those type of things. But there has to be an economic benefit in the end to deploy these. You know, otherwise, it just simply will not work.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I know a friend of ours, Patrick, Jeff Simmons, often talks about the first step in sustainability is profitability, right? Without a profitable company, you can't advance sustainability. You simply don't have a company. And I think that's very well said. Last question, rapid fire round for all of you. Randall, I'm going to start with you. What's the one thing you want entrepreneurs and executives to know about capital? And then bonus, how can they get in touch with you?
Steve actually made a point earlier that capital is available, and it is. So that's the point that I would make to entrepreneurs. And if you want to contact me, I'm on LinkedIn.
Well done, Patrick.
Yeah, I think there's a practical nature when you're out looking for capital. You have to understand your own risk and where you are on the continuum. I think that's really important. But I think on more of a personal note, I'd encourage, you know, entrepreneurs and executives to think about value, not only in terms of economic value, but also personal value. And, you know, economic value is one thing to quantify, but when you think about personal value, that's a little bit harder. And it requires evaluating yourself as much as your business. And I think in the end, you'll need to do both. And the process of sourcing capital is obviously challenging. But if you do that hard work of quantifying personal value and what that means to you and your other stakeholders, you're going to put yourself in a better position for future success. So in terms of getting hold of me, you can go to our website, vinecp.com. You find my email address there, which is patrick@vinecp.com. And feel free to reach out to me. I'd find it personally fulfilling, helping however I can.
Excellent. Patrick, thank you so much. Steve, wrap us up.
Well, you know, I'm going to go back to two things, and I tell this to our customers all the time. When you're looking to source debt, being an organization like ourselves, the more you can limit the unknown and limit the uncertainty, the more comfortable you are going to be working with a lender. And so it's all about really having your house in order when it comes to financials, understanding your strengths and weaknesses. Quality financials are really critical to know historical profitability and the capacity an organization has to take on additional debt and that type of thing. So that historical perspective of strong earnings, or not necessarily strong, but strong quality financials is really critical. So always be prepared. It's changed so much. And again, I said capital has become such a big part of this industry. We got to know our P's and Q's. So, and as far as contacting me, I like Randall. I'm on LinkedIn and pretty active on LinkedIn. So that would be the best way to get a hold of me.
Terrific. Well, Patrick, Steve, Randall, thank you so much for spending time with us today. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Pleasure. Enjoyed it. Take care.
You too. And thank you for tuning into Ag Bioscience. You can get the latest Ag Bioscience news and insights from discussions just like this by subscribing wherever you listen to podcasts. While there, you can access our entire library of archived episodes and give us a review. Don't forget, you can learn more online at agrinovusindiana.com. On behalf of the entire Agrinovus team, I'm Mitch Frazier, saying thanks for listening. We look forward to seeing you real soon.
This podcast is a product of Agrinovus Indiana in collaboration with Inside Indiana Business. Hosted by Mitch Frazier. Produced by Kayla Chittister and Fabian Rodriguez. Photography by Kaylee Kerr. To get all Ag Bioscience news all the time, visit agrinovusindiana.com.